and welcome to Dick and Tom and the Movie Show.
This is a podcast just by two guys who love film.
We're not experts. We don't know everything about it. We haven't even seen some films that you might think you need to see.
In fact, I've seen almost nothing in the last 12 months.
Yeah.
I've probably seen three films.
Which is one less than you've already seen this year, so you're doing quite good.
Yeah, true.
Whereas I have never seen Top Gun.
No, you haven't.
Yeah, that stunned silence said it all, really, didn't it?
Yeah. Among other films.
Yeah, I've never seen Goodfellas.
No.
I've fallen asleep trying to watch The Godfather, parts 1, 2, and 3. There's a few ones that I haven't seen. I haven't seen a lot of classic cinema either, so...
No, okay, I might have you in the classic cinema
You might space. Do, but what I have seen a lot of is I've seen a lot of 80s films.
Yeah.
I've seen a lot of sci-fi films and a lot of action films.
And they're all the good ones, really.
They are all the good ones.
Yeah, yeah. And also, I mean, we're going to be spoiling everything for you as well.
Oh, absolutely.
This isn't... Just a word of warning now. If you're listening to this and you're thinking, hopefully this will help me decide which films to watch, which I haven't already seen, don't do that, because we're going to ruin it all for you.
Yeah.
So I'd probably treat this like a little discussion with your friends.
Yeah.
It's like you're sitting there with a nice cup of tea, and you can join in and laugh along, and you can even talk to us. We won't listen to a word you say, but...
Yeah. Well, listen, we'll leave some pauses for effect. Yeah. So what do you think, guys? Oh, yeah. That's really good, that. Yeah. Oh, you know yourself,
good
don't
stuff.
You? Know yourself. So as this is our first edition, we thought we'd let you know a little bit about us, really.
Yeah.
Now, we talked about this a bit before, and... I think it's only fair that I'll ask the questions. I've got them here in my little notepad. So, Richard, I'm going to ask you a few film questions, all right?
Sure.
We're going to see how this goes. Okay. Best film of 2019?
I saw, like, three. So
well, it should be an easy
So there aren't many to choose between. I'm going to go for Jojo Rabbit, which we will also talk about in more detail later.
Great. Didn't that come out this year?
I saw it this year, yeah, so I can't say that one.
You can't say that one.
So, that's true. But I think did it come out this year? Did it come out at the end of last year?
I'm not sure, but I
saw it this year, so forget that.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll delete that bit. It's got to be Joker then, and I didn't even love it.
No?
I just didn't see that many other films to really compare it to. But it was a good film.
What do you think about Joaquin Phoenix in it?
I tell you what, I've been seeing some weird like Twitter accounts recently who are obsessed with him, and which I just find deeply disturbing. Like he was, and they're like, oh, he should win every award. Like he dislocated his knee kicking the bin in that scene, and cool. I mean, like.
He probably shouldn't have just kicked the bin.
No, just be a better actor. Just kick it with more believability without dislocating your knee. I don't think physical injury is a qualifier for winning an award.
No. All right, so reluctantly, best film of 2019 is Joker.
Yeah.
So I enjoy Joker a lot more than you did by the sounds of it. I think that it's not a canon DC film, and that there's talk of a sequel, but honestly, I think the best thing they could do for the legacy of that movie and its brilliance would be to draw a line under it, because it was such a different version of the Joker, and it was such a character study that I think to do it again and link in more Batman people and stuff would... they'd be making it something it wasn't. And it just happened that it was a good character study film about a supervillain. The fact that he was... this comic book character was a really minor detail of the actual film.
Yeah, I agree. And I don't even think it was about a supervillain. I think it was an interpretation of the idea of Joker.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I think it's best taken away from the whole DC canon thing and just treating it as a completely separate entity. And, yeah, I agree. There doesn't need to be another one.
No.
It's not the Joker who you see in the other Batman films or... I've not read the comics, but in the comics, I imagine it's its own thing entirely. Which is completely valid, but yeah.
Yeah. So my best film of 2019 is kind of an obvious one, Avengers Endgame. I cannot tell you the amount of times I've seen the film. The Marvel franchise, as we'll talk about later in the show and as this series goes on, is something that I'm a huge fan of, and to give away a Star Wars spoiler this early, I would say that Avengers Endgame, for me, was everything that Star Wars Rise of Skywalker wasn't to the Star Wars franchise.
Mm-hmm.
It really felt like it closed some chapters really nicely.
Yeah, yeah. And for anyone doubting Tom's fanboy credentials, he is currently sitting here wearing a Marvel Avengers Infinity War t-shirt. So
yeah, I really am. I went all out. You know, it's the first one of these, so might as well. Okay, next one is Guilty Pleasure. What's your Guilty Pleasure film?
See, I think I'm going to have to go for Love, actually.
Okay, yeah.
Because I know a lot of people hate it, and a lot of people like it as well.
I mean, I think people hate it the longer time goes on, because some of the things in it are obviously a bit outdated.
Yeah.
Some of the portrayals of women are not fantastic.
Yeah.
But name a Christmas film that hasn't got some questionable portrayals, you know.
Well, yeah, like, exactly. It's just, it's a heartwarming, entertaining, funny film with some terrible acting, and, yeah, and some of the subplots are also terrible. But it does everything I need it to do, and I've got really good memories of it.
Yeah.
And I really enjoy watching it every year. So there you go. Shoot me.
Okay. Best film of all time.
Yeah, I mean, now, yeah, we were talking about this beforehand, and this one I find a difficult question.
Yeah.
Even just when anyone asks me, like, in everyday life. Are we saying my favourite film of all time?
Or yeah, like, we're going to say your favourite film of all time. Or, like, the
best film. I guess they're different things.
Well, or maybe best is subjective, I don't know. I don't know.
I mean, I do feel like this isn't a good answer, but I don't know where else to turn. Mm. So, on the theme of Joker, definitely my favourite film I've ever experienced.
Yeah.
Kind of, and this is taken into context, kind of, yeah, how much I enjoyed it at the time. Whether it stands up compared to the other film I've seen, I don't know. But, The Dark Knight.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, look, it's not lowbrow, but it's not highbrow.
No, but it is a Christopher Nolan film.
It's a Christopher Nolan film, yeah. And I just love it. I just think it's so good. I just think it does the grittiness and the darkness of kind of comic books like no one else has done.
Yeah.
I think it was kind of the peak of that phase of kind of comic book films. And also has the best kind of villain-hero dynamic that I've ever seen. And obviously we don't need to talk about Heath Ledger and that performance, but it was a very good performance. Mm. R.I.P. And yeah, I just, every time I watch it, I want it to keep going. I don't want it to end. I just think it's a really excellent film.
So that's a great choice for best film of all time. That is probably on my top three list. I've done a sort of top three, so I had that one.
Of course you have.
The one that I love is Muppet's Christmas Carol. Yeah, I know, but really? It's Michael Caine's finest work. And it's Kermit's finest work. I just love it. It was released...
Wait, and this is your number one?
No, that's number two.
Oh, okay, fine.
That's probably number two.
Okay, fine.
Okay? Number one is Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. Now, do you know what? A lot of people like Temple of Doom for the whole Kalima thing. But one of my most iconic lines of cinema of all time that my dad always referenced to me as a kid and that I still say when I see someone do something stupid is the Knight's line of, "He chose poorly." And it's just like the pathos with which he delivers this, having been stuck in a cave for like thousands of years, or like 1500 years, or however long he's been there, is brilliant. So, not true, just for
true,
that moment.
True genius.
But yeah, So I'm a big indie fan. So that's okay. So that's up there.
I'm not sure I've seen all of the indie films.
And we're going to rectify that.
Yeah.
Right on this podcast.
I don't know. I think I've seen some of them.
Well, let me tell you, you don't need to see the last one, The Crystal Skull.
I've definitely seen that one.
It was just like George Lucas was like, guys, what do we need? And they went, aliens. And instead of going, it's okay, I've already got a franchise with aliens, he went, yeah, why not? Because Harrison Ford ain't getting any younger.
Which is, I think, a fair reason to make a film.
So to kick off our first podcast here, we thought there is no better place to start than Star Wars.
Star Wars.
The Force will be with you.
Always.
Star Wars... The Rise of Skywalker. We went to see it.
We did, and that's what it's called.
Now, full disclosure, when we went to see it the other day, I'd already seen it. So I saw it when it came out on opening night, went to the midnight showing.
Of course you did.
Because I have nothing better to do with my time. So for those of you that are listening to this because you love the sound of our voices and don't know anything about Star Wars... Very briefly, this is obviously the 9th and final trilogy film in the Skywalker saga, which started with A New Hope back in 1977, went through the good trilogy. George Lucas then picked it up again with the bad trilogy in the late 90s and early noughties.
Which is the trilogy, I mean, we grew up with.
Is the trilogy
and when I was 8, it wasn't bad.
No, and you know what? I've been having this discussion with another friend of mine, and I still rate that lightsaber battle in Attack of the Clones. Because, like, all the Jedi, like 50, 60 Jedi in this arena.
Or in the pit.
In the pit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, that was boss. That was so good.
Yeah, there was some really good bits.
I think the trouble with the episode 4 onwards is that there's only ever, like, one Jedi, right?
Yeah, yeah. Which so really limits the amount of Jedi fighting there can be. Which, I mean, come on, is... Clearly the best bit.
It is the best bit.
Yeah.
I'm playing Jedi Fallen Order on the PlayStation, as you know. And the best bit, I just want more lightsaber. I don't want climbing.
Yeah,
I don't want puzzle solving.
No.
I want lightsabers. So let's have some thoughts. Kick us off, Rich.
Sure. Okay. So I liked it.
You said enough. You said that through gritted teeth.
I didn't hate it.
Yeah.
And look, I'm not a huge Star Wars like fan or kind of particular nerd with it. Like I love sci-fi films, I love sci-fi books and games and all that stuff. For some reason Star Wars has never been the one that's like gripped me the most. But you know, I've seen all the films and I grew up with the bad trilogy.
We should probably call it the prequel trilogy.
The prequel trilogy. That one. And I've seen all the most recent Star Wars films. And I thought it was a reasonable end to the series. I didn't think it was brilliant. I didn't think, as a standalone film, it was anything special. But I think it tied things up in a nice enough way. Slightly disappointing, I think, considering what the whole thing could have been, and the amount of kind of like lore and backstory and potential that comes with Star Wars, like a little bit of a whimper, but still like a neat enough little bow was tied at the end of it.
Yeah, there was only kind of, I mean, the only real dangler they left was the whole what was Finn gonna tell Rey. In the pit thing.
Yeah, I mean, and was that even, like, it was just going to be, like, I love you, wasn't it, really? Was
well,
it
this is the else? Thing, because a lot of people want Finpo to be a thing, right?
Yeah.
But there was an interview with J.J. Abrams where he went, it can mean whatever you want it to mean. Which is like, right, it's a bit Christopher Nolan end of Inception spinning top thing,
yeah, a little
it?
Bit. I mean, I think it was in there as a joke. As, like, a... and there's a thing that we talk about afterwards. I don't think they really, I think they knew what he was going to say or particularly cared.
No.
So yeah, I mean, they kind of left that, but very little else was left. I mean, of course, it's always kind of, well, in another 100 Star Wars years, you know, what's going to happen? Will the Sith have to come back? Because obviously you think after the first trilogy, it's kind of over, they've won.
Yeah. Well, this is the thing, they've said, you know, you could tell it was always planned for 9 films, even if these 3 weren't the films that George Lucas planned. Because to leave the whole of Star Wars on Revenge of the Sith, which is such a bummer, because obviously Ewan McGregor's screaming at Anakin, and then, you know, Natalie Portman dies in childbirth. Like, it is a huge down at the end of that film.
Yeah, yeah.
And for that to be like, there you go, guys, that's all you're going to get, was never really going to happen. I think for me, there were lots of classic Star Wars moments. Like, there were some new planets that were great.
Yeah.
There were some really good lightsaber battles. I think what lost it for me was that they seem to have changed the rules somewhat. In that, all the way throughout the first 6 films, and even, you know, the 7th film, basically, you know, because I loved Force Awakens, thought that was a brilliant reintroduction to the franchise for a lot of people, is they set up the Force as this thing that you need to be very delicate around, and this thing that, you know, you channel through you either negatively or positively, and that you had to really learn the abilities. And then, just in this one, she's got Force lightning coming out of her hands. She's practiced for, like, 10 minutes on a planet, floating with some rocks, and she's bringing a transport down from the sky. I'm like, I don't buy it. She's Force healing.
Yeah.
You know, Ben Solo becomes one with the Force, and I don't know why. Like, it all started for me in The Last Jedi, when Leia flies back into the ship. So you said this about 2 minutes into watching Rise of Skywalker.
Yeah, I thought she was still dead. I don't remember her coming back to life.
Yeah, so she flew from outer space, which, and this isn't something that's been long established as the Jedi being able to do.
Yeah.
But she flew back into the ship.
Despite being, like, frozen. And
she's dead. Pretty much frozen. She, and then she, like, force flew.
Yeah.
Which was, you know, I felt like it was kind of a thing that, in hindsight, because obviously the late, great Carrie Fisher, you know, has passed away since then, they probably should have ended the Leia character there.
Yeah, and I mean, and on that, I did find much of the whole Leia thing in Rise of Skywalker cheap.
It was really shoehorned in.
Like,
wasn't
it really was shoehorned in. It was really a way of skipping over The Last Jedi, because J.J. Abrams clearly didn't really care for it, and shoehorning in the plot he wanted, and yeah, like, it's all kind of pre-recorded stuff. It didn't. There was that one scene where Rey's like talking to Leia, and like is, and there's a lot of like looks, but Leia, like, all she says in the scene is like, "Yes,
yeah,"
and because there was nothing more, but they were trying to shoehorn like a plot moment into it where Rey went off back to do something.
It was, "I'll go without your permission."
Yeah, exactly.
"I don't want to."
And so, like Rey had to like say Leia's lines for her, because obviously there were no lines. And so much of that felt like weird and forced.
That was the theme of the whole film for me, really. I mean, The Last Jedi, for better or for worse, had some good moments. The whole bit where they're going off to find the hacker, there was a lot of side plot in The Last Jedi for me. It felt like a lot of that film was, you know, optional extras you'd have on a video game that you could go back and do once you'd completed the main
side missions. Yeah.
So I could have done without that. But you know what? The scene where they're on the salt plains and Kylo Ren is dealing with, you know, Force hologram Luke Skywalker is classic. That bit's brilliant. But rather than taking that, and albeit imperfect film, and running with it, it seems what J.J. Abrams had was he had a plan for the 3 films, and he's gone, okay, hard left, and then suddenly, you know, the first 3 words of the crawl at the beginning is the dead speak, and we're just supposed to believe that Emperor Palpatine is back, despite having no indication for that really in the first couple of films. People were saying all Snoke's a puppet of the Emperor, but that, there were like 70 theories for who Snoke was. And for me, it was just like, okay, right, first 2 minutes of the film, okay, that's the Emperor, we know him. I would have liked some build-up to that. You know, I need, you know, buy me dinner and a movie first, you know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah, and, look, and whether, I guess whether J.J. Abrams liked the second film or not, you can't just pretend it didn't happen, can you?
Yeah.
You can't just go, nope, didn't see that, I'm going to do my own thing now. You have to at least acknowledge it and at least take what happened and like run with it in some way. And he didn't. He just completely, rewrote essentially what he think happened in the second film.
And it might have been a better film had he have directed the number two.
Yeah, maybe.
You know, but he didn't. It was funny, I read an article today that said about some of the reshoot scenes, and that the two ones that they added in was the scene where Poe and Rey are having an argument about the ship, about how they wanted some levity and they wanted some more meat to that relationship. I personally don't think it added anything to the film. And the other scene they added in was Luke and Rey on Akto, when she crashes Ren's ship, sets it on fire, goes to throw the lightsaber in, and Luke catches it at the last minute, and she says, "No, I'm going to cut myself off from the Force," and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Was not in it. But from what I've heard, from what I've read, again, it may or may not be true, the Disney executives went, "We need some Luke Skywalker in this film about Luke Skywalker." Because otherwise, the only bit that they would have had is his little voice cameo and then him showing up at the very end.
Yeah.
So it was interesting to note that maybe J.J. Abrams either thought, well, he is dead, let's get rid of him, or whether he would have killed him off in the second one. Sorry, not killed him off. Made him become one with the Force in the second one or not.
Yeah.
But either way, I think there were a lot of great Star Wars moments. You know, Lando Calrissian showing back up was great. And C-3PO, after being really dry and really, you know, lacking any sort of real punch as a character in the first 8 films, absolutely came to life. He was a big plus for me.
I really like that they gave C-3PO his moment.
It feels like Anthony Daniels went, "Can I just ad-lib some stuff and let me riff?" And those were really great.
Yeah.
Babu Frick.
Babu Frick is really cool. I think we both want a little Babu Frick just to live with us.
Yeah.
Be my ship.
Yeah.
I mean, like, there was... Yeah, obviously, it's, like, a really nostalgic film. There was a lot of, throwbacks and callbacks.
Yeah.
And some of that kind of was nice and, like, was kind of... It felt right. Some of it was probably a bit kind of overdone.
Yeah. Like, the ending... Although nice to see Tatooine again, the ending was extremely saccharine.
Yeah.
To the point of me being like, okay, well, it's done now.
Yeah.
So I think it's a very flawed film, but there are still some nice moments for Star Wars fans out there. So, Star Wars The Rise of Skywalker. Richard, what are you giving it out of 10?
I'm giving Star Wars 6 Skywalkers out of 10.
6 Skywalkers out of 10?
Yeah.
Interesting. I'm going to have to give it 5 Skywalkers out of 10.
Okay.
There was a lot of moments in it for the fans, a lot of cool Star Warsy bits, but really lacked on plot and... really lacked on...
Being a good film,
basically. So, yeah.
Wow.
So there we go. That was Star Wars, The Rise of Skywalker. So now we move on to our second film of this month's podcast. It is Jojo Rabbit.
He's Marshal Jojo. You're a top man. Prepare to leave the house.
Today you boys will be involved in such activities as war games, ambush techniques, and blowing stuff up.
I don't think I can do this.
Russ? Of course you can.
So this is the most recent film we've seen.
Yeah.
We'll look up as to whether it came out last year or this year.
Yeah, yeah.
But we saw it this year.
God damn it, we saw it this
year. Yes, we did.
Yeah.
So Jojo Rabbit, again, for those of you that aren't familiar, is the story of a young boy in the Hitler Youth who is battling his own conscience as his mother is hiding out a young Jewish girl inside his house. And
it's- I mean, let's also not forget that his imaginary friend is Hitler.
That's kind of a big point.
I think that's a key aspect of the film.
That's kind of a huge point.
Yeah.
And before we go on to say anything about the actual film, Taika Waititi is absolutely hilarious.
I mean, he's everything he touches turns to very good, doesn't it?
It really is. Just,
with that classic phrase.
Yeah.
He's a funny guy, isn't he?
He is, and I hadn't seen him. Well, I say I hadn't seen him in anything, but like it was interesting to see him, you know, and see himself actually acting.
Yeah, because it wasn't all like jokes and comedy, was it? Like there were serious bits of acting in there.
There were serious bits of acting, yeah. But like a lot of the time, these films that you write, direct, star in yourself can tend to be vanity projects. Can tend to, you know, you can let one of those aspects slip. But this isn't the case with Jojo Rabbit, because Taika Waititi is fantastic in it. But also, Roman Griffin Davis as young Jojo. He's a young man, but it's brilliant. I think he's 10.
Yeah.
I'm just going to double check that, but I think he's 10 years old.
Yeah, I mean, like...
He's 12 now, so he would have been 11 when it was being filmed, but, you know.
Sure, I mean, yeah, that's pretty impressive.
It was terrific work. He carries a lot of the film, you know. Yeah. Not in the sense of, you know... Everybody's not pulling their weight, but he is the bulk of the film.
Yeah, no, like he has a lot of time on screen.
And I think Scarlett Johansson does a brilliant job.
Yeah.
She comes in, she plays it with a lot of heart in quite a dark situation. So it's probably worth saying that this is inherently kind of a comedy film, but it's got some real dark twists to it, you know. It's definitely... I mean, the ending where... Again, heavy spoilers because this is us. The ending where we see that she's been caught for hiding the Jewish girl, and you never see her. All you see is her shoes, and that's how Jojo recognizes her. It's heartbreaking, and it took us, the audience, a second to twig on to what had actually happened.
Yeah, I think it's easy by surprise, definitely.
But the ability to have that kind of plot twist and still retain the heart of the film. That we see when he eventually, you know, tells the young girl that it's safe and that the war's been won by the Allies when he takes her out into the street. To still retain that heart, it takes some doing.
Yeah, it's like somehow not a tragedy.
Yeah.
Despite, like a 10-year-old's mum dying.
Well, this is the thing, and, you know, it kind of brings into focus maybe what a lot of war films don't tend to, because they're very focused on the soldiers in the field, is that there was a lot of sacrifices made at home on both sides, you know, to try and keep some sort of peace. And for Jojo, who spends the entire film thinking Hitler's his imaginary best friend, trying to do everything he can to win the Hitler Youth over and to go and eventually fight the front for Germany. You know, that's something that in a war film you don't often see, the what goes on at home. And I thought it was really refreshing. I'm not a huge war film guy myself.
Yeah, you have recently stated that we've had enough.
But it brought, for me, a real fresh aspect to the war. And I think the way that he does it with so much comedy and heart makes it so much more accessible. Because if it was just a regular old stuffy war film, I might not have wanted to go see it.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think the concepts of it was pretty, like, inflammatory as well. I definitely saw a lot of people who were kind of, like, unaware of what the film was actually about, like, really having an issue with it.
So,
like, there were people going crazy on, like, on the internet and stuff. Why is there a film about, like, Hitler? Why are we, like, glorifying the Hitler Youth?
I mean, but this is the thing, it does none of those things. But
obviously not. But yeah, like the it's a really inflammatory concept, and it's like really hard to do. Like the taking a concept like that, literally, just like starring Hitler in your comedy film with like a young boy. Yeah, I mean, like it was really, really difficult, and it was a really kind of fine line that Taika Waititi had to tread to get that right. And I think he did get it right. It was genuinely funny, and it was like touching and heartwarming and kind of meaningful, and it wasn't kind of glorifying in any kind of way. And it did make you think. It did make you question a lot of things. I don't know what things. Some things.
I was about to say, I couldn't have said it better myself.
But yeah.
But it does, it makes you question the perspective of, like I said before, the people at home. That's not often what you see in war films. And if you are, they're often portrayed as being very helpless, being very passive. And I think for this one, to have, you know, the role of Scarlett Johansson really actively seeking to end the war, seeking to, you know, shelter
protect Jews from being persecuted. Not supportive. And I think that's, look, we all hate Nazis, right? I hate Nazis.
Oh, many a day shooting them down on Call of Duty. Yeah,
exactly. Especially the zombies.
Yeah,
yeah. We all hate Nazis. I think we can all agree on that. As something we have in common as a nation. Is that we really hate Nazis. But what it does do is actually like give some kind of like sympathy or like three-dimensionality to like Germans during the war. So I can't remember his name even, but the Nazi like head of the Hitler Youth in that town?
Sam Rockwell's character.
Sam Rockwell. So Sam Rockwell's character has depth.
Yeah.
He's just like a conflicted guy, like a strange guy. He wears makeup and dresses and is definitely homosexual. All things which I don't think Nazis generally considers, you know, it's not what you think when you think Nazi.
And of course at the end he saves JoJo.
And on more than one occasion, he's kind of like a hero figure, like he saves JoJo, and he's still a Nazi, but I think he's a guy who is probably amoral, if nothing else.
Yeah.
Who just happens to have been fighting in the war.
Wanted to fight, I think. He wasn't particularly...
Is that what his thing was?
...on for the cause. He just seemed like... he'd suffered a setback on his name and he just wanted some personal glory. You know, when he comes out in the end strident in hilarious uniform that he jokes about earlier in the film and runs into battle with utmost seriousness, because he might not take the cause that seriously, but he does take himself very seriously. And, you know, it was a brilliant character and it really added... It didn't have very many of the stock... basic Nazi, basic opposition or Axis or bad guy characters that you would get in a lot of films. You know, the Stephen Merchant character when he comes in as part of the Gestapo is, you know, hilarious. There's the scene when they're all in the house and they discover Elsa, who they actually think is Jojo's dead sister. It's all... the tension is built brilliantly. It's all... I mean, the scene where they do about 75 Heil Hitlers between them.
Yeah,
it's hilarious. And it takes the piss out of the notion of them being really serious about this salute to their Führer. And all of these, you know, terribly weird and fascist Nazi things that they did. And it really shines a light on them and goes, look at this, isn't this ridiculous? And that's where he's done a great job, as opposed to showing it in its... most hardened truth form, then having a Hitler best friend would probably be a little bit cringy. But the way he's managed to pull it out the bag in this film is brilliant.
Yeah, yeah.
So, Jojo Rabbit, Richard, how many are you giving it out of 10?
I'm giving Jojo Rabbit 8.5 Heil Hitlers out of 10.
You're giving it 8.5 Heil Hitlers out of 10.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, I'm going to give it 8 Heil Hitlers out of 10. Just minus the one Heil.
The half a Heil.
The half a Heil. Well, no, there's a Heil, there's no Hitler. Right, see what I did there? Yeah.
Okay, all right.
Brilliant. So, we are here with the first guest of the series.
Yay!
Laura and the MCU.
Now, as many of you have already gathered from the very short time you've been listening to this podcast, I am a huge Marvel Cinematic Universe fan. I'm wearing the t-shirt, I've got the DVDs, I'm going to pre-order the game as soon as it's available, and it was much to my surprise to find out that my darling fiancé has never seen an MCU film.
Boo.
Boo is exactly...
I don't actually care, but boo.
Yeah. Thank you for the support. Thank you for the support. So I thought it would be a good idea to get you. This is Laura, everybody.
Hi.
You can find her on Twitter at...
Laura_double_England.
If you want to tell her her opinions are terrible or great. So, a couple of days ago, I sat you down and made you watch your first MCU film, didn't I, babe?
You did indeed.
It was?
It was a film.
No, what was the title of the film?
It was Iron Man, which I called it. The Iron Man the other day.
You did call it the Iron Man.
Is that wrong?
Ridiculous. Yeah.
It was wrong.
It
was objectively wrong.
Okay, objectively wrong. Fine. I'm fine with it.
So that's what it's going to be.
Why did you start with Iron Man?
Well, you've got to start with Iron Man because you've got to... This is a... I know what you're going to say. You're going to say, hey, Tom, don't you watch it in chronological order of the times that the film was set?
Yeah.
But no, you don't. Because the problem is, if you then take that logic, you're watching, like, Captain America the First Avenger and then Captain Marvel, and you're watching, like, these films with no context of the universe. So in Captain Marvel, obviously, there's Nick Fury, there's the Kree, there's the Skrulls, and all of that sort of thing, which you ain't going to have diddly squat knowledge of if you haven't watched Guardians of the Galaxy. I'm sorry.
That was really easy.
Yeah.
So basically...
That was really... I know. It's like 10 minutes in this podcast and you've already...
So basically, he had very strong opinions and I don't care. So that's basically what happened.
But you should watch them. If anyone's not watched them or you're re-watching them,
Tom, watch them in
order of release.
Nobody cares, Tom.
If they're listening to this podcast, there is a slight chance... Somebody might care, okay? So that's what we're going to do. So tell us about Iron Man before I get any more indignant.
Okay, so let me talk about The Iron Man. Iron Man. I'm just going to say this for like 1 minute. And just The Iron Man.
I have the power of editing, don't push me.
It's true. Okay, so in bold for some reason at the beginning of my notes is just I fancy Robert Downey Jr., I don't know where that came from.
Okay.
But there it is.
Cool.
But even with... Because we love Tony Stark, but even with the facial hair?
Well, not sure about the facial hair, but about 20 seconds in...
Yeah.
There was already sexism coming in, creeping in with that character. I know he's supposed to be a nasty character. He's supposed to be annoying, is he not?
Well, at the start.
At the beginning, yeah. So we can have a great character journey that didn't happen. So... Basically, there's about 10 different moments about in the first 10 minutes I worked at. I think it was 9:03. So there's a bit when he comments on one soldier being a woman and makes a joke out of it. There's a bit in a casino with like loads of blondes. There's a bit with a reporter. There's a woman wrapped in a bedsheet. Nobody does that. Like, I've literally never wrapped myself in a bedsheet ever. That never, ever happens.
Why not? Sometimes upon a casual morn, I'll... awaken and want to watch the sunrise that I can't see because our house overlooks a ditch.
Right. Okay. Richard, have you ever wrapped a bed sheet centrally around yourself?
I know he has.
Because I tell you something, if there's a woman out there that has done this actually in real life, I will
eat my words. And you can write in and tell us about it.
Please tell
or
us.
Or don't, hashtag me too.
Okay, I wrote this very funny little quip because I think I'm cool. I wrote, Gwyneth Paltrow is so uptight, it looks like she's got her jade egg up her vagina in the film. Which is quite rude. And
that is also quite a reference, and clearly Richard does not understand the reference to a jade egg.
No. So Gwyneth Paltrow's whole wellness thing that she's got going now, she's obsessed with the idea of jade eggs.
What are jade eggs?
Well, it's an egg made out of jade.
Oh,
like the stone. Right.
So, do you know what I was thinking?
You were thinking that was a brand of sex toy.
No, not that.
It's literally a jade egg.
That was number two. Okay. But my first thought was like a JPEG. I thought it was some product.
It's like a Polaroid.
Which was like J, then like DEG. Like, I don't know why. I was seeing JPEG, but JDEG.
Love that.
Who knows what it. But right, it's a jade egg.
Yeah, it's like Gwyneth Paltrow's thing.
Going back to what we were saying about Indiana Jones, you know, like the crystal skull?
Yeah.
It's like having one of them up in there.
Sure, okay.
Yeah.
Which does nothing, but, you know, she's rich, so she can say
she says a lot of stuff like that these days. And I also wrote about Gwyneth Paltrow. I don't like Gwyneth Paltrow, I'm discovering from these very, very quickly.
Oh, okay.
Gwyneth Paltrow wears a suit, so we know we should respect her, because she's the only one Tony respects.
This is true.
So far, so classic. Anyway, I got a bit mad about this, because I wrote a lot of comments about the treatment of women. However, what can we just talk about the private plane with the stripper air hostesses just for a minute?
Yeah.
What's that about?
Sorry, have you never been on a private plane with stripper air hostesses?
No, I mean, you get them all the time.
Yeah.
I thought they were behaving very strangely, and then there was a poll, and I was like, oh my gosh.
It's probably Donald Trump's plane, to be fair.
Also, why does everybody who gets blown up, because obviously there's a lot of bang bang, you're dead, as my mum would affectionately call it, and in the beginning when he gets blown up, everyone always ends up with, like, two perfectly formed cuts on their face, on their head. But, like, one at the top, just a very small cut, and then one just above their eyebrow, maybe in their eyebrow, just... But they've been, like, in bloody wars or in, like...
Listen, do you know
explosions?
The strain? Do you know the strain a large-budget production film does on a makeup crew?
Yeah, but surely, like, if you were in an explosion and you basically make, like, the most powerful missiles...
What if, like, Lawrence from Hair and Makeup was off that day and only Brenda was in and she just had to quickly do all the extras?
Brenda works really hard, okay?
Anyway. She does. She probably
does. Yeah.
I was enjoying the drama between him and Obadiah Stane.
Yeah.
Obadiah?
So Obadiah Stane, who was running Stark Industries up to Tony's 21st birthday. And
him very, very early on. That was a very obvious... thing that was coming.
I mean, he's played by Jeff Bridges.
His name is Stane. It's literally Stane.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then what else did I... Oh, yeah. There was a great moment, actually, because I was told that to make these notes, I couldn't actually say these comments to Tom. Normally, I say them to Tom while he tries to watch the film in complete silence, and I think I'm hilarious.
Sounds like this was a good tactic, because I enjoyed that screening. Yeah.
Yeah, if no one's guessed so far, by the way, I'm not sure we mentioned it, these two are actually engaged.
I think I did mention it.
Did you?
I think I did. Yeah.
I don't remember you mentioning it, but...
Before he walked out on me for Gwyneth Paltrow, but there you go.
Engaged with conditions.
Karen Gillan, I kind of get, though. Anyway, at one point I turned to him and I was like... It was when the Iron Man... When he makes a suit in the cave and...
Just Iron Man, but cool.
When the Iron Man is sort of like... He starts to fly. And I turned to Tom and I said, he can fly! And then Tom looked... at me in a sort of shady way, and then immediately he fell, and I was like, oh, he's trying not to spoil that for me, but yeah, he could not fly early on, could he? Not well.
Okay.
All right.
So, your first MCU film.
Right.
Iron Man.
Yeah.
Just Iron Man.
The Iron Man, yeah.
Just Iron Man.
Yeah, The Iron Man. Got it.
So, your first MCU film, Iron Man, how many arc reactors are you giving it out of 10?
I give it 5¾ arc reactors.
What's the ¾?
I didn't know you had 3/4.
I didn't.
Well, I just made my own rule.
Why 3/4?
Well, I don't know. You believed that a guy could have two cuts on his face after being blown up by missiles, so...
So that's where that quarter went.
Three quarters is fine.
But you didn't hate it.
Do you know what? I didn't hate it. There were a few moments of good, truthful acting and some actually, yeah, which I didn't really talk about.
Okay. What, from
Iron Man?
RB?
Not really from him. Mostly from... No, from the guy that dies really early
You
on.
Like Jensen.
Jensen, yeah. In the cave. Oh, poor Jensen. My heart went out to him and his family.
Yeah.
And all that. But there you go.
So the next film we're going to watch together, me and you, is The Incredible Hulk.
Okay.
Do you feel better about that? Or
I don't know. I feel like I'm excited to see him get angry and turn into a big green monster. I don't know.
That's a better level of base knowledge than I expected.
to be fair.
Yeah.
I mean, you're about to be very confused, as we were when we experienced it for the first time, by the imminent casting changes that are going to happen to very recognisable characters in this universe.
That's very weird.
It's really weird, you are right.
Can you make me a spreadsheet?
Yes, I would actually love that.
Okay.
So, yeah. That was Laura and the MCU.
Laura and the MCU.
So the third film we'll be discussing this week is The Gentleman.
I want you to imagine a character. Your boss, Mickey Pearson.
You're too smart to be blackmailing us, Fletcher.
Sweet Mary Jane is my vice. Your poison, on the other hand, is and always has been the destroyer of worlds.
You're out of touch, and I would like you to consider an offer.
So The Gentleman was pretty much a Guy Ritchie film.
Yeah, I mean, like, okay, I've got to put my cards on the table here.
Yeah,
I don't think I've seen Lock, Stock.
Oh, and Two Smoking Barrels.
No,
me neither.
Uh-uh.
Yeah.
So I mean, like, when people, because people talk,
should we be hosting a film podcast?
I don't. No,
we're doing it anyway. Let's. You know.
Yeah, yeah. No, let's see how it goes. I don't think I've seen any.
Oh, you've seen the Guy Ritchie film.
What have I seen?
Robert Downey Jr. Sherlock Holmes films.
Oh, okay, fine.
Yeah. So those.
Yeah,
are Guy
no,
Ritchie
I
films.
Forgot they're Guy Ritchie. That is Guy Ritchie. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, I mean, like, I guess, like, stylistically, then.
Snatch? You can,
maybe?
I've not seen Snatch.
No.
Rock and Roller's one I've seen. I saw it years ago.
Right, okay.
Years and years and years ago.
Yeah.
It's only 12 years old. Man from U.N.C.L.E.?
Oh,
no, I think it had Henry Cavill.
Henry Cavill, yeah. No, I have seen that.
And then he also did the Disney reboot that, you know... Everybody needs these new live-action Disney films. He did Aladdin.
Oh, I did not see that.
I actually... Do you know what? It got a lot of stick. I didn't think it was too bad.
Okay.
Because... Well, various reasons. But we're not here to discuss
that. We're not, no.
That was not a quintessential Guy Ritchie film, but this absolutely was.
When you hear the name Guy Ritchie, you kind of know what you're getting, right? Like, you know what you're expecting.
Yeah, you expect certain things. You expect guns.
Yeah.
Right.
Sex, probably.
Yeah, the C word, a lot.
A lot of that. Drugs, definitely.
Yeah, definitely.
And probably, yeah, like, humour, which... is on the line.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the Independent Review described this film best when they said it was definitely an equal opportunities offender, in that if you are Asian, if you are Jewish, if you are black, if you are anything, you're basically going to be offended by this film.
Yeah, yeah, I think it's probably a fair assessment.
Yeah. That being said, I personally found it an enjoyable watch. Yeah, there were some really uncomfortable moments, but I think if you're going to go to see this film, it's worth it just for Hugh Grant alone, because he was in such... He was playing such against type, and it was really interesting to see him leading the whole narrative of the film.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I've never seen Hugh Grant in that kind of role, right? Like,
no, definitely not. He's always in, you know, Four Weddings or Bridget Jones or Love Actually.
He's just awkward posh guy, isn't he?
Yeah,
That's his thing.
Mm-hmm.
And he wasn't in this film.
Like, no,
yeah, amazingly.
And it was
But you liked it.
I enjoyed it. Yeah, I like. I'm sure we'll talk lots about it, but I actually thought that the uses of the C word, which we do draw the line at saying on this, chocolate, of course.
The
use of the C word for me was used to good effect. I know it's a lot of people's critique of it is that it felt overused, and I'm guessing by the look on your face that you kind of feel the same. However, I thought that was comical. I thought the use of violence in Guy Ritchie films, although in parts can be gratuitous, it's always cleverly done with humour, you know. There's always a lot of...
Yeah.
The moment where they're bundling Big Dave, Eddie Marson's character, into the back of the van, and rather than have a big choreographed fight sequence, the security guard just goes, "Nah, I'm not paid enough for this," and then they bundle, you know... Taking those moments to step back and almost poke fun at the genre itself, that really worked for me. I thought the plot was good. I thought all the performances were good. I could not pin Charlie Hunnam's accent.
Yeah, I don't know. Was he, like, Yorkshire?
Well, I mean, like, he's a Geordie.
Is he? So was he, like, doing... I don't think he was, like, a Geordie
but
accent.
But it didn't feel like a Geordie
accent. Yeah, was it, like, kind of a bit Brummy? I'm not really sure.
Mm.
I wasn't sure about his performance as a whole, if I'm honest.
Right, okay, interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, like, physically he, like, looks the part. And kind of, yeah, has the presence for it, but I don't know if I loved his performance. Yeah, I'm not sure he kind of, yeah, always hit the mark for me.
Yeah. I mean, for me, if you want a film that's a good action gangster film, you know, it's a story about Matthew McConaughey's character, who, you know, has this drug empire and he's trying to wind down and get out of the game and go into retirement, and obviously, you know, calamity slash hilarity ensues. But I thought it really did what it said in the tin. It had that Guy Ritchie guarantee on it, and I came away entertained.
Yeah, yeah. And you know what? I can't deny it had that Guy Ritchie kind of stamp all over it. Like, if that's what you're into and that's what you're expecting, you're going to get it, and you get a whole film full of it. Like, it didn't let anyone down in that respect. And I didn't love it. I also didn't hate it.
Yeah.
Like, especially on reflection, I think there was a lot about it which I quite enjoyed. Like, yeah, I did think the plot was good. I thought Hugh Grant was, like, interesting. And, like, a fun character. And the violence, even. Like, I actually didn't, like, weirdly, like, considering what I'm about to say about other things, like, I was fine with the gratuitous violence. Like, that's all good. But I just didn't find it that funny.
Right.
I didn't really laugh.
The one thing about it, because there were a lot of moments that I found funny, I especially like where he draws on the screen and, you know, has the interactive kind of storytelling element to the film. The rap video was quite funny.
Yeah, like, I thought it was kind of, like, clever. I found it a little bit forced. I don't know. I think...
Go on.
Maybe, yeah. Maybe I kind of... I'd kind of gotten partway into the film and had decided I wasn't going to like...
Right.
Kind of the rest of it.
And so, you got entrenched in it.
Yeah, so anything that happened, even things like the rap video, like, Bugsy Malone, like, which really, like, objectively, like, was kind of funny. Yeah. I was like, no, I don't like this.
Yeah.
It's, like, forced and, like, not actually, like...
It felt a bit shoehorned in, and it felt... The only thing that, plot-wise, felt a little on the edge for me, because, as I say, I did find it very entertaining, but Colin Farrell was great and stuff. It felt like his character arrived merely to sort of clean everything up as a plot device.
Yeah.
It felt like that was a very late addition in the script.
Yeah, he was a bit of a, and I'm going to say this wrong, Deus Ex Machina?
Yeah.
Is that you say out loud?
Yeah, I think so.
There you go.
Well, nobody really knows because it's Latin and Latin's a dead language.
This is true, so you can say however you want.
You can.
But yeah, no, he was... Yeah, a bit of a plot device.
Yeah.
He kind of was very convenient and, like, very proficient at sorting everything out. So
yeah, and for somebody that protested a lot about, I don't want to kill anyone, lads, I don't want to do this, he killed a few people, and like,
yeah, no, you know, he really, and he did it well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think...
You definitely had done that before.
I think the Farrell doth protest too much.
Quite possibly. But, so I'll... Look, my problem with the film is this.
Okay.
And, look, I may be accused of being woke.
Okay.
I may be accused of being a snowflake.
Don't let Lawrence Fox hear you say this.
My problem is this.
He's not listening. He's too busy making terrible music.
Yeah, this is true. Does he make music?
Have you heard it?
No.
Oh, man.
I don't want to.
Oh, man. I'm not even going to put any in this podcast.
Yeah, please don't.
It's like brown noise, honestly. You don't want to hear that. You don't want to hear that. Anyway, continue.
Anyway, right. My problem with the film is this. Look, I'm all for, like, edgy humour. I'm all for kind of being on the line and a little bit of offence here and there. Like, that's all fine. I just felt like the film probably, to me... was actually a bit racist, and well, actually wasn't that sexist. That was one thing it wasn't, but no. Homophobic and anti-Semitic, and all around just a little bit dodge on most of that stuff. And if you were to defend the film, you say, "Oh well, look, it's these characters in this kind of in this world. They're going to be like that. That's how they were raised. It's how they are." And you have to kind of take a step back, but. I just didn't think there was any balance to it.
Mm.
I didn't think it gave kind of the opportunity to view it that way. If anything, it was kind of there to be like enjoyed and laughed at by people who sympathise with those things. So probably if you like are a bit anti-Semitic, some of the like Jewish remarks, you go, "Ha, yeah, like that's funny. Like that reinforces what I believe."
Mm.
And I felt like it was a bit like that for a lot of the humour.
I think for me, I'd say. 75% of the time in the film, I was like, "Ah," I was like, that is amusing. Like, just, you know, don't get me wrong. At no point in the film was I raucously slapping my thighs and laughing.
Yeah, yeah.
But there were lots of times where I went, "Ha, oh, that's funny." You know, just those one-off sort of moments, or you know, something where you sort of chuckled at the way the plot worked out. But they, this is the thing, when you talk about being an equal opportunities offender, which I said earlier.
Yeah.
And I felt like, for a lot of ways it did, but it didn't offend everyone.
No.
There's not going to be any white working class British people that come out of that film offended.
But look, it didn't offend me.
Yeah.
As a middle class white guy, as a straight middle class white guy, there was nothing in there which I was like, "Ooh." That's right. Oh, he's targeting me there. Like,
no, and that I think is that is part of the problem, isn't it? Because we're like, "Oh, it's fine. It's offending everyone else that isn't me."
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, I think the trouble is when you're someone like Guy Ritchie, like you can. I don't know whether it's a thing with him, but you can hide it in what was for me an entertaining film.
It's possibly a problem, like with the film. In that it's like masking those, like for me at least, it's like it's masking those like issues in this kind of entertainment, and this like romp,
and it does it well.
It does. You know. So yeah, a lot of people really enjoyed it, and I enjoyed it kind of in the main.
This is probably the one that, for anybody listening to this podcast, we'd probably like to hear your views on the most.
Yeah.
Obviously Star Wars as well, but I think this one is quite divisive. Like, it's got a good Rotten Tomatoes score.
Yeah, like, it's really well received.
But there are a lot of critics that have said essentially what you've said.
Yeah.
And I think they're very valid points. So it's now time for us to rate The Gentleman. Richard... how many Hugh Grants out of 10 are you giving it?
I'm giving The Gentleman 5 Hugh Grants out of 10.
Okay, 5. That's, to be honest, that's not too bad. After our conversation we had the other day, where you explained your grading system and said that basically anything from 2 to 8 is poor.
Yeah, I mean, that is how I view the world.
Yeah.
But, yeah, no, I think a solid 5. I think if you'd asked me straight after I'd seen the film, I maybe would have given it a 2 or a 3. But on reflection, I think it is...
a bit better than that. So no, I'm going for 5 Hugh Grants.
Yeah, you see, that's the opposite for me, because I probably would have given it 7 or 8 Hugh Grants out of 10. Probably nearer 8, to be honest, because I was very entertained. But upon reflection and upon our discussion of hearing some of the issues and getting them out loud, I'd probably have to give it 6 Hugh Grants.
Oh, well, there we go.
I think it was a good, entertaining film. I would like to hear some thoughts on this, so please tweet us at DictonMovies if you've got any thoughts on this film as well, because it is quite divisive. But I think those are some fair scores.
Yeah, I think so too.
So the fourth and final film that we are going to discuss between us is 1917.
I hoped today might be a good day. Hope is a dangerous thing.
You have a brother in the 2nd Battalion.
Yes, sir.
They're walking into a trap. Your orders are to deliver a message calling off tomorrow morning's attack. If you fail, it will be a massacre.
Let's talk about this for a minute.
Why?
So 1917, the war epic by Sam Mendes. We made a very good decision prior to this, which was that we booked to see it in IMAX.
Yeah, I mean, like, if you're going to see any film in IMAX ever in your life, I think probably 1917 is the one.
Yeah. And I think the starting point for this to talk about is just that what an incredible spectacle and feat of filmmaking this was.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, like, I've never seen anything like it.
No.
It really was, like, incredible.
So if you've seen it, I'm sure you'll agree with us. If you haven't, the film was filmed in a style that made it look like essentially two consecutive continuous shots that took you round on a single camera focus through the entire film. Roger Deakins, who's worked a lot with Sam Mendes before, the great cinematographer, who also worked with the Coen brothers and Denis Villeneuve, really pulled off something incredible here, because the way they pulled off the scenes like the tripwire going off, and the running long beach scene, which I'm sure, the trench, thank you, that I'm sure we've all seen the behind the scenes footage of.
Yeah.
The way they've pulled off these shots is an incredible feat.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like, if you've ever seen Atonement, have you seen Atonement? Yeah, yes. Like, if you've seen Atonement, there's that, like, 5-minute long scene in there, which is that one panning shot across the beach, which I love. And the film itself is fairly average. But that one scene itself is kind of one of my favourite scenes in, like, cinema history, I think.
Yeah.
But it's a whole film of that. It's an hour and a half of that scene. But more, if anything. I've seen some people kind of take the piss a bit out of the whole one-shot thing.
But I think it's an incredible feat, and I think the story that Sam Mendes has written is a very basic story. You know, it's two people that are sent to the front line to get a message there. But the way that he's written it, and the way that he's written the simplicity of it, and the camaraderie of it between George Mackay and Dean Charles Chapman's characters throughout it, really just allows you, through that single shot technique, to focus in on that story and to focus in on their brilliant acting performances as well. I thought that the lead two guys in it, you know, Schofield and Blake, were just incredible. And to have that ability as an actor myself to see somebody that is doing 45 minutes or an hour long shot of cinema where, you know, if you mess it up even a tiny bit, you've got to go all the way back to the start. To be able to get a full take of that was such a great feat. So,
yeah.
I mean, what were the... I haven't seen much naysaying. What were the
I mean, there were definitely cuts, right? Like, they definitely... There were...
I think two in the whole film.
Is that... Really? Yeah. I've heard that there were, like, many more cuts than that. And they're, like, quite well, like, hidden.
I think there was two. There was definitely one where they passed behind the trench, and then I think the other one might have been the explosion.
There's a blackout, which obviously
in the
in the explosion. But I think I've seen people essentially say, look, it's full of like 100 cuts. It should say like mask them quite well. And to be honest, yeah, I don't know the facts. I'm sure you can find out. I don't really care.
Mm.
I don't really care how many cuts it is. That's not really the point.
Yeah.
It's not about kind of, oh, did they film it in one or two shots or whatever. It's about kind of the end product that you get.
Yeah.
It's about kind of the type of film which is like unique. Mm-hmm. It's something which kind of hasn't been done before.
And it's the fact that you really feel in this film like you're following their story, like you are part of it. It feels almost like, at times, a sort of third-person game.
Yeah, it feels like a game. It does.
Because it's an hour and a half to 2 hours of really intense watching. We both said that we sort of had that tension headache coming out because you feel so much, and it's credit to Sam Mendes and Roger Deakins, that you feel so much like you're a part of the story. And every time they pass through another checkpoint on their way to do what they're doing, you feel that sense of relief with them. And I think that's testament to the brilliant filmmaking.
Yeah, yeah. And you know what, Tom?
Yeah.
Recently, you said to me, and I can't remember because we recorded this 2 weeks ago, whether we mentioned it earlier in the podcast. But you've said to me recently, Tom, that you think there are enough war films.
Yeah, so I'm quite happy to state that again.
Yeah, however,
yeah,
you really like this film.
As in,
you've come out of it and you really enjoyed it.
So I struggle to see many of the war films that have particularly been released in the last sort of 5 years or so. I struggle to see what they add to the narrative that we still need to understand from these wars. Because obviously there's a lot of tragedy that happened, and a lot of lessons to have been learnt. But I feel like the film industry has just been leaning towards, you know, there's a guaranteed audience for these, which I know you can say of a Marvel film or whatever, but I feel like they say there's a guaranteed audience for them, and the variation in plots from film to film, I feel, has been very minimal. This felt very different. This felt human on such a personal level in a way that I haven't seen since things like Saving Private Ryan or Band of Brothers.
I mean, I'd even argue it's not even really a war film.
No.
I mean, it's set during a war, set during World War One. But is the film about World War One, or is it about like the journey these two guys make, these two friends make? Is it about kind of the filmmaking on a kind of wider level? I feel like you could set it anywhere in a sense, which is kind of a stupid thing to say, but yeah, it's not really a war film in the traditional sense, and I like it for that.
No, it's not. You know, it's not really partisan. You know, of course, there are times when, you know, they're talking derogatorily about the Germans or whoever, you know, on the opposing side, as you're going to get with any war film. But it didn't feel like it was partisan or overly patriotic.
Yeah.
It felt like it was a story about two people. And the other thing I'd like to raise is the brilliance of casting two relative newcomers
to
those roles. Because, yes, okay, you've got Benedict Cumberbatch and Andrew Scott and, you know, some other fantastic cameos, Colin Firth popping up throughout the film. But they didn't feel like they were there because they were trying to reel you in. They just felt like they were there as people of perceived higher status, which, you know, in your mind, for seeing them and recognising them from so many other things, they kind of were.
Yeah, yeah.
But for an established, terrific filmmaker and director like Sam Mendes to cast these two lads in these roles, and to have them carry the film, basically, because, you know, obviously Schofield is in shot for the entire film. To put that kind of faith and responsibility on someone like that, his career's going to absolutely skyrocket, and rightly so, because he was fantastic. And I think that's brilliant to see in an industry that so often doesn't allow people to take their first big chance. He's really given that to a couple of people, and I think that's commendable. So, ratings out of 10 then. How many medals of valor are you going to give it out of 10?
Okay. So, I'm going to give it 8.5 medals of valor out of 10.
Okay, wow, you left me hanging on the 0.5.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, you can have a little half medal in there.
So, what's the 0.5 about?
Right, okay. So, I would have given it more. Maybe a 9. Maybe even a 9.5.
Wow.
However, weirdly, the thing that I really like about the film also is stopping me from doing that. So, the very, simplicity of it, the very simplicity of the plot is a great feature of it, I think. I think it means that you can focus on the kind of cinematography, you can focus on, the atmosphere and the feeling of the film. It doesn't distract from anything else. They don't try too hard, they don't try and make it any more than it is. However, because of that, it can't reach into kind of being one of the greatest films. It can't reach to being that really kind of that top tier of kind of best ever films, because it just lacks some of the things you need for that. I think it doesn't give the opportunity for those kind of incredible Oscar winning performances, or for kind of the cleverness and complexity of some of the kind of best films of all time. So yeah, I love it for its simplicity. But at the same time, that's what's kind of giving it a ceiling for me.
I get you. I think that's fair. So I'm going to give it 9 medals of valor out of 10.
Yeah.
I'd probably knock the mark off for the fact that in an hour and a half, they've, I know there's a section when he's knocked out.
Yeah.
But in that amount of time, they have achieved what they meant to achieve, and it seemed a little bit squished in.
Yeah.
In that they got very far, very fast. You know, they got to that town.
Yeah, and he was nearly there.
And he was nearly there after about 45 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's where I knock off the mark, but I still think it's probably one of the best films I've seen in this Oscar period. Just comparing it to some of the other ones that are up for.
I mean, it's definitely one of the favourite films, one of my favourite films I've ever seen, in the cinema.
Oh, absolutely.
The experience of watching it, probably, one of the best I've ever had. I don't know whether it's a film that I'd want to watch again and again, though. I think I've experienced it. I've seen the spectacle, and I was really impressed, and maybe I don't have a great desire to go watch it on repeat.
Yeah. There we go. 8.5 and 9 out of 10.
Nice.
So some other good films that we've seen this month. I've made it to a few more on account of being unemployed this month. So if anybody's looking at me, you can find me at Thomas Cove. You'll see my Spotlight CV on there. I saw Bombshell, which was the biopic about the Megyn Kelly, Roger Ailes era of Fox News, when Roger Ailes was accused of sexual misconduct and was subsequently fired from Fox News. Well, he should have been fired. He was, obviously allowed to quit. But that was a brilliant film. That was very good. Just rattling off quickly, because I know you didn't see it, Richard.
Yeah.
Charlize Theron gave a brilliant performance as Megyn Kelly. Very strong female-led film with 3 female leads, which you don't often see. So that was a big tick for me. There were moments where it was a little slow going, so that takes it off. But I will give it 7 lawsuits out of 10.
Nice.
So that was really good.
Yeah, pretty good.
I also got to see Little Women the other day.
Ah, you did?
I did. And after being very sceptical, because I'm not a huge fan of period pieces,
mm-hmm.
I thought it was a really lovely film. It's a real slow burner for the first sort of half hour. But if you can ride through that, there's some great performances, notably Florence Pugh, who plays the second youngest of the March sisters, is brilliant.
Yeah.
Meryl Streep has a fantastic cameo. It even had Bob Odenkirk in there, which I thought was great. But it was a really well-made film. The adapted screenplay by Greta Gerwig was fantastic. that's one that I can see winning a few Oscars as well, if I'm honest. I thought Saoirse Ronan, for me, as Jo, missed the mark a little bit. But if I had to put money on anyone winning an Oscar, it would be Florence Pugh for that performance.
Okay.
Because she was great. So I will give Little Women 8 Little Women out of 10. I feel like that's the only thing.
Simple, but
I feel like that's the only thing you can give it, really. So another film that I saw this month on my unemployment daytime cinema trips.
You've really been going hard.
I've really been hitting it hard. This is the thing, guys, and I'm trying to convince Richard to re-sign up for it. If you don't have a Cineworld Unlimited card, you need to get one in your life. They are the most useful things. I've been to the cinema, I think, 6 or 7 times this month. I've got to be 8. I've been 8 times this month, I think. And I'm only paying £20 for that. And that is such a big saving, you know. Obviously, we know that whatever cinema you go to, prices are going up. And to pay £20 for that, I'm paying like... What's the, I mean, my maths is horrendous, but it's like £3-4.
Well, you pay like £3 a movie. Yeah, that was not a paid advertisement.
No. But Cineworld, if you want to duke us anything...
Yeah, I mean, like, if you want to pay us to advertise, then we're up for
all
it.
All I'm saying is,
yeah,
Odeon were also on the phone.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah. View.
I don't think they have a service, do
they? No, they don't, but they can still give us free stuff, so...
They will. But what I will say is that our cinema of choice has always been Cineworld, hasn't it?
This is true. This is true.
But one of the films I went to see was Just Mercy, which was the Jamie Foxx and Michael B. Jordan story about a man who is wrongly convicted and, you know, put to trial and goes on death row. And it's the story of how this Alabama town... and the sheriff's department and the DA and everybody colluded in this sort of cover-up to convict the wrong man. And it really was a heartwarming story of the battles that still in 1990s America, that, you know, black people in the South were having to overcome. And I know that we've got such a lot of problems still in some of these states and in this country and a lot of countries all over the world. But what was brilliant about it was to see the people in it come together, not with hate or violence or anything like that, but was to see this community of people put a well-reasoned, calm, but passionate and emotive argument across and eventually get justice. And that was really beautiful to see. It really brought a tear to the eye. For those that have, you know, been on death row and you know, weren't as lucky. So I would really recommend that.
I've got a tear in my eye now.
I know.
That was really heartwarming, Tom.
Oh, good. Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it. But I would highly recommend you to go see that. I would give that... I would give it 8 judicial courts out of 10. It feels weird giving it one of our novelty things, but it was a really... especially in the time we live, it was a really important film to have seen.
I hadn't even heard of that one, to be honest. That went under the radar for me.
It did. It went under the radar for me as well until another friend of mine said, hey, there's this film on, you know, Jamie Foxx, Michael B. Jordan, Brie Larson is great in it as well. And that was one of those films, unlike 1917, where I saw the actors in it, didn't know much about it, knew that I'd like those people, so took a gamble on the ticket.
Yeah.
And boy, did it pay off.
Oh, well, I'm glad it did. I'm glad it did. Well, look, I have not been to the cinema this month. However, I have caught one other film this month.
Oh, you did?
I did, yeah. And
was it a recent film?
No,
okay.
It was.
Okay.
it really wasn't.
Bring it on.
I don't even know when it came out. I think 2015 or something.
Right.
But yeah, I saw Downsizing on Netflix.
Oh, the Matt Damon one.
The Matt Damon one.
I think that was more recent. I think Downsizing is like 2018.
Is it?
I think it was...
I don't know. I feel like I looked it up.
I'm going to immediately look this up. 2017.
Sure. 2017, fine. So kind of in the middle. But yeah, and I remember seeing the trailers for this back in 2017 and thinking, ah, what an interesting concept.
Yeah.
That looks like that could really be good.
Nope.
Nope. Yeah. One of the worst films I've ever seen. I mean, like, and not even... The, like, I don't have the words to describe how bad it was. Like I've seen some bad films in my life where I've still weirdly, like, perversely been entertained. Yeah. The same with that, like, you saw Cats, and obviously it was awful,
but I had a good time.
Yeah, had a good time. Like, yeah,
because I was laughing at the irony.
Yeah, I mean, like, The Wicker Man with Nicolas Cage.
Oh, when they break his knees or ankles. Or knees. Oh, it's so
and
funny.
And he kicks people in the face. Yeah. Like, that's entertaining. Downsizing has no redeeming features.
No.
Because not only is it just disappointing from what the concept kind of promises, it's just boring.
Yeah.
It's so boring. And I know we're only supposed to be quickly going over these films that we've seen, and this came out 3 years ago, but I just had to get it out. Like, if you're thinking about watching Downsizing on Netflix, don't.
Yeah. Watch The Witcher.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like, if I was going to give it, like, little people out of 10...
How many tiny Matt Damons out of 10 would you give
I'm giving it, like, one tiny
you're
Matt
giving
Damon.
It one tiny yeah. Matt Damon. And is that just for Kristen Wiig being a bit weird in it?
If anything... Like, in spite of Kristen Wiig being a bit weird in it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, don't see it.
So, we're going to look ahead now and see what we're going to watch next month.
Oh, yeah.
So, the first one that is technically released this month, but I think we're probably going to get around to watching next week and review for you all next month, is A Beautiful Day in the Neighbourhood. Which is the Mr. Rogers biopic.
I'm looking forward to that.
Starring
one.
Tom Hanks. And if you say the words starring Tom Hanks at the end of any description of a film, sold.
It's already got, like, this has got a base rating of 5 for me already.
Yeah. Just by
saying Tom Hanks there, like, you can only go up.
It really can only go up. So we're going to try and see that one. Personal History of David Copperfield has just come out.
I want to see that. I'm really looking forward
to it. I mean, it's an Armando Iannucci film. It's going to be...
I love Iannucci. I like Dickens.
Yeah.
The trailers look funny. I'm up for it.
Tick, tick, tick. So we've got those two. I'm also going to drag you to see The Grudge.
Yeah, I'm not really a horror kind of guy.
You're not. You're one of those annoying people that laughs when they're sort of made to jump.
I think it's a defense mechanism, to be honest.
I mean, it is, but it's still kind of infuriating when you're watching a film and that happens. I was telling another friend of ours today that I wanted to go see it, and apparently, I'll have to fact check this, but apparently it's got a rating of 4 on Rotten Tomatoes.
Like 4%.
4%. Which makes me want to see it more, right? Because I want to see something
A bit like seeing Cats. There is something, like, enjoyable about watching a terrible film, isn't
there? So there's Parasite as well. The Korean film about the family that all live in the basement. That has been nominated for so many Oscars as well. So I'm really intrigued to see that.
Yeah.
And... something that's changed my life whilst being a Londoner is the ability to tolerate subtitles. I've previously not been a big fan, but when you're on the Northern Line at 8:40 in the morning, you need subtitles.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, I've recently started using them as well on the tube.
Yeah.
Because I found a TV show which I'm really into, and I've been smashing it on the way to work and back. And I've had subtitles on the whole
Toss
time.
Toss a coin to your witcher.
It's not The Witcher.
Oh, valley of plenty.
No, it's actually... which I'm watching that and it's good.
Yeah.
But that's not what I'm talking about. I'm watching The Expanse on Amazon Prime, which is like a sci-fi kind of like show, which I was sceptical of at first, but I love it.
Great.
But
basically, if you live in London and you commute on the tube,
you need subtitles. So I'm a convert.
So we'll go see Parasite. That looks like another good one. There's also Greed, the new film with Steve Coogan, which looks good, where he plays the self-made billionaire who has a bit of a crisis with
his
business.
He's very serious these days, isn't he, Steve Coogan?
He is, although it's supposed to be a very dark comedy, that one.
Oh, right, okay.
So that sounds like it's going to be pretty good. So I think that's what's coming up next month. We're going to try to see a few of those, aren't we?
Let's do it.
So that's about it for this edition of the podcast. Let us know what you thought of all the movies. Let us know what you thought of our thoughts, more importantly, of all the movies. If you think we're talking utter nonsense. Or if you agree with us, you can find us on Twitter. Where can they find us, Richard?
They can find us at DickTomMovies.
Otherwise, thanks very much for listening, and we'll see you real soon. Dick and Tom and the Movie Show is a podcast featuring Richard White and Thomas Cove with music by Tim Shaw. You can listen to us on MKFM, Spotify, eventsmanage.co.uk and all other good podcast hosting platforms. Any trailer materials used in this podcast are not owned by us, but used for promotional purposes only.